All right, so if we're casting for the movie of the Ukraine saga, who plays who in the movie? Obviously, Fiona Hill is being played by Tilda Swinton.
No, Kristen Sock Thomas.
What? No.
Totally.
I don't know.
Margaret, who's playing Ulrich Brechtel?
Wait, can we get through some primary characters? No, go ahead, please.
That's Margaret's favorite character in the whole. Because I think it's just that she likes saying his name.
I think Ulrich Brechtel should play Ulrich Brechtel.
It's his own ghostly presence.
Yes.
I want Gordon Sondland to be played by an actor, but I'm afraid he's dead. The guy from Princess Bride who says, it's inconceivable.
Yeah.
Oh, Wallace Shawn.
Yes, he's not dead, right?
And I don't think
okay,
so.
Good, he's
but
available.
But I want Mike Pompeo to be played by somebody who is dead, which is Fred Thompson.
No, John Goodman plays Mike Pompeo.
And Wilford Brimley plays John Bolton.
Who's John Bolton?
Wilford Brimley.
Oh, no, actually, Tom Hanks is John Bolton.
What?
Nuance, depth, let him show off his chops a little bit. Okay. Tilda Swinton can play John Bolton.
Perfect. She could. She could handle the role. She's got the chops.
Perfect. She could play him well. Hello, and welcome to Rational Security, the Lonely Amigo edition.
Can we be the four amigos?
Well, I was going to say, which one of us is the loneliest amigo?
It's Tammy, because
she's off on her own.
Off
in Bahrain.
Yes. Amigo-less.
Yeah, we're amigo-less.
Hi, Tammy. Off there on your own.
Chevy Chase could play Gordon Sondland in the movie. It's possible. If the three amigos, by the way, do not have a reunion sketch on Saturday Night Live this weekend, it is the biggest missed opportunity of the week.
When Kurt Volker said, my understanding is the three amigos refers to, and then he started talking about John McCain, I thought for sure he was going to mention Steve Martin, and we have nothing in common, Mr. Volker.
Ay, ay, ay. We are here in the Jungle Studio with Susan Hennessy, Margaret Taylor, and Ben Wittes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
The aforementioned Tammy is in the aforementioned Bahrain amigoing. On the podcast this week, what else? The House of Representatives conducts marathon impeachment hearings with key witnesses, including one lonely amigo, Gordon Sondland, and others. We're going to spend the first two segments unpacking a big, big week. And the last thing we're going to talk about, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Indicted.
He's having a week, too.
Yeah. Well, and they're heading to new elections. It's a big house fire.
It really is. There's a lot going on. All right, let's just dive right in. I want to start with yesterday's hearing with Gordon Sondland. I think fair to say he seemed to me to be the biggest wild card witness. I kind of thought of him that way insofar as he had, you know, given testimony in closed door session. He had then come back and amended it after his memory was refreshed by hearing from other witnesses, which seems like a polite way of saying you're being allowed to amend your testimony so that you're not facing a charge of lying to Congress. And it wasn't clear whether he was going to come in and give, you know, testimony that would be flattering to the president, testimony that would be very harmful to the president. I mean, Margaret, I would like to start with this question with you in the overall, because you've actually read all of the deposition transcripts, so you have this.
Bless you.
You know, like when he's coming in there, like of all the things that Gordon Sondland has said, like you know it. So I'm curious, A, what did you think he was going to present as, or what kind of witness did you think he would be when he came in? And what was your overall impression of the kind of witness that he ended up being?
So I have never met Gordon Sondland. So
anyone here met him? Damn. Okay.
I feel like I know him.
All right.
Well, you know, and when you read someone's deposition transcript, you know, you just don't really always get a sense for who they are. So what I was expecting was for him to sort of come in and not recall lots of things. And there were things that he said I don't recall. What I did not expect was this sort of, you know, spunk he brought to the whole thing. And it was clear that he had sort of just made this decision to come in and be like, you know what, everybody trying to throw me under the bus? I'm going to throw all of you under the bus because here's the deal and here's what was happening and the president was directing us and everybody knew everything.
Tammy had a good line about this last night. She said it's like it wasn't even throwing people under the bus. It was taking a monster truck and just driving over their bodies.
I mean, it really was pretty extraordinary. I just didn't expect it. And it just seemed to me like he just didn't care. And he just did it. And in some ways, it was quite, I thought, sort of endearing in kind of an odd way to see it. So he had a lot more sort of spunk and personality and had clearly made a decision to just come in and, you know, kind of not take the things that have been said about him. So the other thing, though, and I should say this is on the negative side, he's still pressing this idea that somehow he never put it all together, that Burisma and the Bidens was the same thing. And that's just not credible coming from anyone, frankly, involved in this, particularly not Gordon Sondland and not Kurt Volker either. And so that is the one part where I just didn't feel like there was a lot of fidelity that came through.
And he also seemed like he was enjoying the moment. Do you know what I mean? It was almost, there were times where I thought he didn't seem like he was taking this seriously, or that he thought it was a little bit of a joke. And he was just so kind of loose with everything. And it kind of spoke to, I almost thought, like, I mean, frankly, it came across as a kind of an arrogance. I mean, that's how it read to me. Maybe that's unfair. But I thought, you know, like, you're in a really tough spot right now. And you seem to be sort of, maybe it's nervous laughter, but man, you think this is like just like a friendly chat. And no, really, like, this is what you're going to be remembered for the rest of your life.
Yeah, but I think it is arrogance, but it's exactly the kind of testimony you would expect from somebody who doesn't have a real dog in the fight, who is independently wealthy and will go back to an independently wealthy life, who doesn't really care about what happens with Ukraine, who doesn't really care what happens with the United States of America. And he's right. Gordon Sondland's going to be totally fine, notwithstanding the potential legal exposure he might have created for himself. No one's really going to prosecute him for anything. And so why wouldn't this just be sort of a fun, interesting little experience for him? He paid $1 million for this. He might as well get his money's worth. And so
his Westworld experience.
Well, I agree that, you know, I agree with Margaret entirely. And I agree that he was remarkably candid in throwing particular people under the bus. And I think we should reserve some time to talk about one Michael Pompeo, who finds himself quite firmly under the bus. But I did think that the sort of willful ignorance about not understanding that Burisma was the same as Biden, the exact same game that Kurt Volker attempted to play, in a weird way was about attempting to spare the president. He really wasn't willing to take that final step and say, I was the person who had communications with the president. I was the person on the phone with him. This is what he said to me. And so while he makes clear this was the inference I drew, this is what I understood, I do think that he was trying to be sort of cute and delicate in refusing to actually say, look, Burisma was the Bidens. Absolutely everyone involved in this situation knew it. And in a way, I thought Tim Morrison's testimony on the subject, where people said, how did you figure out that Burisma and the Bidens were the same? He said, well, I was taking on a new job. Everybody was mentioning this company I'd never heard of. So I Googled it and Biden came up and I said, oh, it's about the Bidens. Like, any idiot could have put this together. And so this act in which these two obviously sort of reasonably intelligent people, Kurt Volker and Gordon Sondland, are just like astonishingly uncurious about it, like never occurred to them these might be linked. That seemed to me like sort of game playing and really about attempting to preserve their own reputations and a little bit protect the president while also taking everybody else down with them.
Ben, you wrote a really interesting piece yesterday for Lawfare, and which, putting aside the atmospherics and the politics of this moment, you paid very close attention to the facts that Gordon Sondland presented. And you made the argument that he is accusing President Trump of bribery.
Yeah, whether he knows he is or not.
Right. Which, of course, is mentioned in the impeachment clause as a cause for impeaching the president. So explain why you think he provided the evidence of a bribe.
All right. So first of all, this is really more a story about Adam Schiff than it is a story about Gordon Sondland. Sondland is the witness, Adam Schiff. And for this purpose, I think it's actually extremely significant that Adam Schiff was for a number of years an assistant U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. He is somebody who knows how to think about a criminal statute in relation to the witness in front of him. And I'm on the plane from Boston to Washington while this exchange is happening. And, you know, I realize that he is very specifically invoking the two significant elements of the federal bribery statute, which is there a thing of value and is it being exchanged in some direct sense for some kind of consideration in an act of policy or a an official act on the part of a public official. And he is probing Gordon Sondland, you know, very explicitly about those two things. And so, you know, if you look at the transcript of the relevant hearing, which I excerpted and published, and you look at it next to the federal bribery statute, it's very clear that he is trying to set up he's trying to use Gordon Sondland's testimony to establish that the president, in fact, solicited a bribe. And so the actual language of the statute is, whoever being a public official, directly or indirectly, corruptly demands, seeks, receives, accepts, or agrees to receive or accept anything of value personally in return for being influenced in the performance of an official act. That is the contours of the offense. And in this exchange, Schiff kind of methodically walks Sondland through, you know, were you promising some kind of thing of value launching these investigations that were very personally important to the president? And were you doing that in exchange for, or were you as the president conditioning the receipt of those things on the performance of some official act, i.e. granting a White House meeting or releasing this aid to Ukraine? And so, I think it was very powerful and, you know, for a member of Congress, exceedingly skillfully done as a questioner. It was a very elegant line of questioning. And it was exceedingly powerful against the text of the Constitution, which explicitly includes bribery as a basis for impeachment.
Margaret, I want to circle back to what Susan was mentioning about Pompeo and ask for your reaction to this, because there was this moment where Sondland, who admittedly says he has faulty memory or doesn't have great memory, and, you know, says, I don't take notes, and, you know, I meet with world leaders all the time, and maybe that's not such a big deal for me, but maybe it is for you, but not for me. But he did bring messages with him, some of the ones that he was able to get access to. He faulted the State Department for not releasing more. But he has this moment where he reveals a message in which he relays that Mike Pompeo has given direction to the amigos to meet with Rudy Giuliani and seems to be fully aware that Rudy Giuliani is doing his thing at the behest of President Trump. And it really struck me that this is a moment where we've seen Pompeo sort of on the outside of the narrative kind of looking in and criticized by some as somebody who has not been defending career diplomats, did not come out with the statement of support for Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador in Kyiv, when she was under attack by Rudy Giuliani. And now here he is pulled into the narrative as somebody who's telling people, go work with Rudy Giuliani. And that struck me as pushing him into the middle of the story in a way that he hasn't and implicating him in a way he hadn't been yet.
I agree. I think it was sort of a pretty extraordinary kind of moment. I mean, throughout these proceedings until then, we've kind of had this sense of like, well, it's like Pompeo's sort of missing, right? Like all this stuff is going on with Marie Yovanovitch. She gets withdrawn. He never even calls her. He's just sort of a missing entity. And the moment you describe is when, yeah, Pompeo gets sort of pulled into this and it's clear he sort of knows what's going on and is encouraging what is going on. So, yeah, I thought it was a pretty fascinating moment. And you have to wonder what Mike Pompeo is thinking now about what this means for him. And I you know, obviously he's been interested in a potential Senate run in Kansas. I do wonder how this type of thing makes him think about maybe that's pretty appealing at this point to maybe think about going that route. One, you know, question I have is, what are all of these documents? Where are all of these emails? Where is the paperwork? The State Department, it's clear from people's testimony, has been gathering all sorts of documents. And I've been kind of asking around, what about those documents?
They're in Fort Knox.
When are they coming? Are they being, you know, is someone, lawyers of the State Department, going through them and then they're going to be delivered to Congress? Are they never going to be delivered to Congress? What's going on with those documents? Because I think it could reveal a fair amount about these exchanges. And so that's kind of a big question mark in my mind, is what happens with all the documentary evidence that there clearly must be around all of these activities? I'm not unclear what Adam Schiff will do about it.
Yeah, I think that there is a deadline tomorrow, at least a preliminary deadline for the state, for the State Department to produce some of the documents. So we might see them sooner rather than later, in terms of obviously lots and lots of paper is going to exist around this. You know, reporting already suggests that Mike Pompeo is sort of looking for a soft exit from the State Department. He's trying to find a way out to sort of launch this this Senate bid for Senate in Kansas that he appears to still believe is viable. I do think that the longer he stays in office and stays in the cabinet, you know, it's easier for someone like a national security advisor or the legal advisor to the National Security Council or these lower level officials to basically assert executive privilege or absolute immunity and just refuse to come before Congress. That's a very difficult proposition for a cabinet secretary to maintain over a long period of time, in part because they have to come before Congress as a matter of routine oversight, in part because they actually need Congress to play ball with them on a day-to-day basis. And Congress has lots of tools above and beyond sort of the annual appropriations and authorizations process, obviously big sticks, in which to incentivize cabinet members to do things like produce testimony. And so I do think that now that we have testimony, and not just testimony, Gordon Sondland brought receipts, you know, with, you know, emails in which he had Mike Pompeo copied on the email chain, in which Mike Pompeo, you know, responds in the affirmative, which Mike Pompeo suggests whenever Sondland suggests having Trump and Zelensky have this sort of pull aside at a meeting to sort of to discuss these investigations. You know, Mike Pompeo responds and says yes. And so, you know, now that there is, you know, really, really direct evidence of Pompeo's central involvement here and really knowledge about what was going on, I do think that's going to be a very difficult proposition for him, you know, to avoid at some point having to come before Congress under oath. And at a minimum, publicly refuse to answer questions, which, of course, for someone who's thinking about their political future and for someone who has generated a whole lot of tape pounding on the table about how absolutely appalling it would be for a Secretary of State to refuse to comply with ordinary document requests for, you know, from Congress and refuse to recognize, you know, the co-equal branch of government. Namely, he was referring to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the Benghazi hearings. I mean, that is just made for campaign ads. And so, you know, if he's thinking about his own political future here and is really trying to avoid that moment, I wonder if we won't see an earlier exit even than we had suspected in terms of him leaving office.
And just one last thing important to note about Sondland. We don't have to discuss it because I think he made it pretty clear, but started out by saying, yes, there was a quid pro quo. There was a quid pro quo of a White House visit in exchange for these investigations, putting aside the fact that he's like, I don't know anything about the Bidens. But I mean, I thought that was striking. And you saw the White House seizing on the other kind of half of this, which was that he said, well, I wasn't sure if a quid pro quo applied to military aid. So the White House line seems to be, we won't argue there was a quid pro quo on this one thing, but that's not that bad because I guess a White House meeting is not as significant than military aid. That really clarified the message, I thought, for the Democrats and really muddied it for the White House.
Yeah, except for that then Sondland went on to say, I inferred the military aid was a quid pro quo. Mick Mulvaney is someone who is in a position to have first hand knowledge, and Mick Mulvaney said it was a quid pro quo in that sort of
Congressman Castro played Mick Mulvaney's statement.
He actually said more than that, and you know his statement, you know, this was my presumption, got a lot of derisive attention from the Republicans, but the presumption was not based on nothing. The presumption was based on the fact that he met personally with the president, and the president, when he asked, do you want to do this meeting, would you do this meeting, the president said, go talk to Rudy. And when he talked to Rudy Giuliani, Rudy Giuliani told him what the conditions were. that's what the presumption was based on. It's a pretty direct chain.
Yeah. So let's move on now to the next slate of witnesses that were up today. Fiona Hill, who was the top Russia expert and official on the National Security Council, and then David Holmes, who is the senior political officer at the embassy in Kyiv. Actually, Sundland is a good place to pick up with Holmes, so let's start there. Holmes is sort of this character that kind of got added in, like, you know, act three of the play, like, ooh, where did he come from, right? Enter stage right political officer to recount a most unusual lunch that he had with Gordon Sondland in Kyiv the day after Trump's phone call with Zelensky. And just to remind people, this is the lunch where
– it's the loves your ass lunch.
It's the loves your ass. He loves your ass.
I mean, for the rest of this guy's life, he's going to be the guy
loves your ass.
Who overheard the president say – somebody saying to the president, he loves your ass.
So at this lunch, you can picture it. You know, Gordon Sondland is sitting there. Let's just emphasize, by the way, this is a restaurant in the middle of a city crawling with Russian intelligence officers, and he is on an unsecured phone talking to the president of the United States in the middle of a restaurant.
About his ass.
And as Holmes describes it, Sondland is on the phone and says, Gordon Sondland holding for the president. And I like to imagine that Sondland looks at the lunchmates and goes, and winks. But so it's like, okay, so Holmes clearly knows he's on the phone with the president, right? That's been established. And then when he does get through to the president, Trump is yelling so loudly that as Holmes tells it, he has to pick up his phone and he sort of pulls it away from his ear and he winces. And that's how Holmes is then able to overhear the conversation in which the president is talking about investigations and are they going to do it? And Sondland says, yes, that they are. And they love your ass, meaning Zelensky will do anything for you. This is after a brief moment where it seems like he has to remind the president that he's in Kyiv, which is, in fact, in Ukraine. So so there's a little bit of comedy in this exchange. But there's a very important factual exchange, which is here you are a day after the conversation between Zelensky and Trump. And the president is calling and talking to his man on the ground in Ukraine, running Ukraine policy, and says, are they going to do it?
Are they
going to
do it?
Are they going to do it? you know, I think you could tell to some degree, Susan, how much Republicans felt that this was a pretty devastating fact, witnessed by the degree that which they were attacking Holmes and making it seem like he'd been hiding this call. There was an exchange with Jim Jordan where, you know, Jordan made it sound as if Holmes had just kind of flown in and dropped this in at the last minute in coordination with the Democrats, and he had to explain why it was that, you know, he thought that he had transmitted the information about this call to staff in the embassy, and there appears to have been maybe some misunderstanding that they didn't quite understand what Holmes had said. But the point is that now he's come here and he's really, it seems, established a firsthand witness account to the president and Sondland having a conversation about investigations.
Yes, so I think this is one area in which there's a little bit of a risk of losing the thread or forgetting where this all began or thinking that what we're in search of is a link to the president directly and that this is – here it is. Here's the link to the president of the United States' actual involvement. The link to the president of the United States' actual involvement is the call memorandum that the White House itself released in which the president brought this up on the phone with Zelensky. And so we have that. We have that confirmed by the White House really in the most black and white possible terms. And so I think it's important to sort of start and anchor with that point. That said, I think sort of this week of hearings has really been about eliminating any possible Republican defenses kind of one by one. And this moment was, to the extent the Republicans were still trying to pretend as though it wasn't really clear what was going on in this call transcript, and as though this large group of people were freelancing or somehow misunderstood what the president wanted, and that Trump himself really was not looking to extract political favors or political investigations. You know, this is the direct direct link. This is somebody hearing the president mention investigation specifically. And so while it's an important piece of evidence, it's certainly a piece of evidence that makes it even harder for the Republicans to continue to mount what is already a quite untenable defense. It also is additional confirmation of what is abundantly clear. And that's that the president of the United States was driving this from the very beginning, that nobody else was really, that with the exception of Rudy Giuliani, nobody else in the administration was trying to walk him down this path. They were all trying to get him to do something else. They were all trying to sort of channel these impulses into productive U.S.-Ukraine relations. And so, you know, again, this is just yet another sort of piece of evidence on the table that just makes it indisputable that this was driven by the president of the United States and that what he wanted was investigations into political opponents, and that he was withholding both military aid and these White House meetings in exchange for that. And so it's not surprising the Republicans are really trying to go all in on attacking this. That said, Holmes was a very clear and credible witness today, and I don't think they advanced their cause much in suggesting somehow he was making this up or had hidden it.
And just to foot stomp on that a little bit, I mean, the thing that struck me about the Fiona Hill's testimony today and also Holmes was, you know, Republicans would ask them questions which they expected sort of one-word answers or for the witness to be a little bit, unsure. But instead, what they got from both of these witnesses were detailed, you know, firm, clear answers, long answers. And I think it really put Republicans on their heels because, you know, Holmes was up there saying he remembered, you know, where everyone was sitting at the table at the lunch. He remembered that they ordered wine. He remembered that he was sitting close enough to someone to share an appetizer. Like all of these details that if you're sort of just making something up, you don't make up all these details. And so their attempts to sort of poke holes in him just didn't work because he had just all of this, the backstory. He had all of the sort of explanation for why he understood the conversation the way that he did. Fiona Hill, same thing. You know, she just has this incredible wealth of knowledge. And in particular, the Republican counsel questioner, Castor, would sort of ask her some questions expecting, or maybe he thought he knew what the answer was, and she would just sort of launch into a long explanation in a very cogent and clear way, and giving, you know, the whoever's watching these hearings just a much fuller understanding of what was going on. And all of it was really damning for the president.
And he even tried to cut her off at some point. He's like, yeah, that's enough. That's enough. She's like, oh, no. And she kept going. Yeah.
Look, but I think one thing we're seeing here is a pretty clear skill differential. And so I'm seeing a lot of people sort of on Twitter talking about, you know, Steve Castor is a bad lawyer. You know, they should have gotten a good lawyer. I don't think it's a question of a good or bad lawyer. There's this notion that either you're a good lawyer and you can do all these things, or you're a bad lawyer and you're an idiot and you can't do it. Questioning witnesses in this sort of a setting is a skill. It's a skill that needs to be developed. It's a very, very particular skill set. There's a reason why Dan Goldman is very good at this. There's a reason why Adam Schiff is very good at this. It's because they've had a lot of practice and they know how to control a witness, how to develop a narrative, how to ask a question designed to get a specific answer from a witness. When the witness doesn't give you the answer you're expecting, going back, cleaning it up, laying it down, making sure they give you exactly what you want. And so, you know, I don't have much sympathy for any of the Republicans, and I have very much less sympathy than I did for Steve Castor earlier this week after watching him sort of attempt to launch this this really gross smear of Alexander Vindman sort of suggesting that what was clearly a joke offer for him to become the Ukrainian defense minister was somehow a reason to actually genuinely question his loyalty. I think that was an incredibly ugly moment. But I think we're seeing two things. One is just the Republicans being really dramatically outmatched on a skill level. And keep in mind, both Castor and Jim Jordan were specifically brought to the committee to accomplish this task. This is not them just working with what they had on the committee. They actually brought people over to do this, and they're working with really, really damaging, devastating facts.
Yeah, I don't think it is just about a skill differential. I think, you know, Fiona Hill and actually Gordon Sondland was a very skilled witness as well in a weird, goofy kind of way. But these are people who and certainly, you know, the witnesses last week, Kent and Yovanovitch and Taylor. These are people who will hold up really well under questioning. And one reason is that they're telling the truth. And it's relatively easy to hold up under even good questioning. And I agree with Susan that the questioning isn't especially skilled on the Republican side. It's relatively easy to hold up under even good questioning if you happen to remember stuff and you're recounting what you remember accurately. And that's not to say that there's no skill to being a witness, but these are very good witnesses, and they're people who have a powerful memory of a very upsetting set of events, and they are recounting that memory and shaking them off of it. You know, I even tweeted this morning before Fiona started testifying that a little warning to Republicans who were inclined to sort of treat her patronizingly or trying to generate a kind of good C-SPAN moment that, you know, she's smarter than you and she's going to embarrass you. And that has kind of happened over and over again. And I just tweeted while we were talking, retweeted it with a, you know, don't say I didn't warn you. Like, this is a situation where they're outmatched. And yes, there's a skills element of that, but there's also a witness quality element and there's also a fact element.
Well, and this speaks, I think, into kind of an information asymmetry that's at play here as well, which is that Fiona Hill doesn't just come to this as a witness of events that she saw in the White House. She comes to this as somebody who had access to copious amounts of intelligence about Russia's interference, about what was going on in Ukraine, and frankly, to this question that has come up again and again, largely through the questioning of Devin Nunes about, so, you know, alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election. And if you're tuning in and hearing the name Alexandra Chalupa a lot, right, which probably strikes most people as, what are you talking about? Is that, that is, you know, this theory, I hesitate to even call it a theory, that the real culprit of interference in the 2016 campaign was Ukraine. And I thought that one of the things that Fiona Hill clearly wanted to do, and it very much got under Devin Nunes' skin, was deliver a very public and forceful message directed at members of the committee that this theory is BS. And I'm going to just read really quickly, you know, what she had to say about it. Based on questions and statements I have heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. Key part. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. That is not Fiona Hill opining. That is the former NSC director for Russia making a statement under oath about what is behind that claim. And I think she clearly wanted that to land with some authority, and then went on to say that when members of Congress are up here propagating this theory, for which there is no evidence, let's be very clear, you're doing what Russia wants. You're helping them out. And I thought that was just such a powerful moment for, you know, a televised hearing. And it didn't really resonate with Republicans. Devin Nunes' response to that was to have printed out a copy of the Republican Majority Report's investigation of the Russian election interference and have it handed to her while she was, you know, sitting in the audience. And you could kind of see her thinking, like, you're missing the point.
Yeah, I mean, look, in order for a line like that to land, you have to be capable of feeling shame. And that's a capacity that Devin Nunes lost at some point relatively early along the way. And, you know, if shame were capable of restraining behavior would have been restrained a long time ago. But I totally agree with you that if there is a moment that should have induced a kind of sucking in your gut and like, Jesus, what are we doing? This would have been one of them.
And just as a coda to this, the White House, after Fiona Hill testified, put out a statement that said, Schiff and congressional Democrats are playing right into Russia's hands. Fiona Hill warned today that it is Russia's goal to delegitimize the president of the United States, which
notably,
I retweeted by saying this is the opposite of what Hill was saying and what she was warning lawmakers about.
Also, she was talking about delegitimizing the presidency
Correct.
Of the United States, a rather important distinction
yeah,
from the
so.
President personally.
I do think, though, Fiona Hill, and as you all have said, I think she did a real service for these proceedings because she was really able to kind of step back and start to put things into the broader perspective of why this impeachment inquiry, at least for me, why it's important to do. Because I think there's a little bit of sort of noise out there, but this is, we're talking about meetings and phone calls, and why are we talking about meetings and phone calls and all this stuff? And I'm not really sure why this is important. So I feel like today, with her testimony, she brought us all out again about why it's really important to be doing this and figuring out what happened and really understanding what's going on here, because it's important for the future of our country. You know, she really was kind of making that point. And I think that is a point that people who, you know, favor impeachment, the Democrats, are going to need to be making over and over and over again, because, you know, Americans just out there living their lives, you know, they don't think about Ukraine every day. They don't think about what ambassadors do. But it's super important for people to understand why this is important in the context of national security. I think she did a good job on that.
So Donald Trump's not the only world leader having a big week.
Yeah.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu indicted on charges of bribery, fraud, breach of trust. That is the headline from the Washington Post, datelined out of Jerusalem this afternoon. Ben, we've talked a lot on the podcast about Bibi Netanyahu's legal troubles, but it seems like this has come to a big moment. What is the indictment about? And refresh our memory how we got here.
Right. So these are a number of different cases. It is in no sense a surprise that Bibi has been indicted. The question in the Israeli political and legal system has always been not really whether he would be indicted, but whether he would merely be indicted for breach of trust, which is a comparatively low-level offense and would have been, I think, seen as a victory for him, or whether he would also be indicted for bribery and sort of more higher-level crimes. The issues are pretty varied. They range from and I have not read the indictment, which, as far as I know, is not in English yet, but they range from, you know, sort of fraud in a telecommunications contracting situation to a supposed bribery situation with the head of a newspaper, in which he basically offered to stop advantaging a different newspaper in exchange for more favorable coverage. And, you know, there's the Netanyahu's like to live large. He's into the finer things in life, cigars and
ice cream.
Pink champagne.
Was there an ice cream thing?
There may
for
have
a
been
while?
Some ice cream involved. And, you know, it is stuff that is not of, in any sense, of geopolitical importance, but is the kind of garden variety graft in which, frankly, other prominent Israeli politicians have been ensnared in too, including Netanyahu's predecessor, Ehud Olmert, who was in prison for a while on grafty kind of stuff as well. And look, the major significance of this is that Netanyahu has been in power for a long time. Unlike the president of the United States, the prime minister of Israel is in fact amenable to criminal process. And his own attorney general, his appointed attorney general, whom he has very little ability to control, his own police force, which, you know, he is a national police force, did this investigation while he was prime minister, indicted him while he was prime minister. Whether he can hold his coalition together, Israel is kind of between governments right now, and nobody is currently able to put together a government. They've had two elections in an attempt to form a government. They've both been kind of stalemates in which nobody has been able to produce a government. And so, you know, the big question is, does this weaken him sufficiently that some coalition now forms around him? Some of his own party maybe abandon him, or can he kind of hold that those 55 right-wing seats, right-wing and religious seats that have pledged themselves to him and head into elections and still kind of prevail even with this happening? I do think it is striking that his reaction to this whole investigation is remarkably Trumpian. I mean, he tweeted today that this was an attempted coup and that the investigators need to be investigated. And I mean, you can just cut and paste Bibi into Trump tweets and Trump into Bibi tweets, and it is remarkably similar.
I mean, like, and one of the interesting things will be kind of a real-time, real-world experiment on the pros and cons of the U.S. system versus the Israeli system. And, you know, to the extent that having a president who oversees the Justice Department and we do not formally have that law enforcement independence, to the extent that that's helped create sort of a strong and flexible and politically accountable presidency, are we seeing that sort of the other side of that now and sort of the inability to hold a president accountable in situations in which political polarization and partisanship have created conditions in which Congress just isn't willing to fulfill sort of the obligations of its branch on a bipartisan basis, you know, versus this other system that is offering a quite interesting example of the ability to hold, you know, political leaders accountable for criminal wrongdoing. And so it's not going to be good for either country to go through this, but it, like, from a purely empirical, you know, sort of constitutional legal theory and political science standpoint, I do think it's going to be interesting to watch it play out in real time and see if this basically identical strategy by Trump and Bibi, you know, pay off in both places, or if they fail to work in one and work in the other, and what does that mean?
And Ben, isn't it also the case that if Netanyahu had been able to form a government, you know, back in May, that wasn't he pushing a law that would have shielded him exactly from this indictment? So it's almost like we almost didn't get there. It really was the outcome of the election in May that has sort of, and the inability to pass that law that has sort of led to this moment in some respects.
That's exactly right. So when Netanyahu tried to put together a coalition in May and failed, one of the major goals that he had for that coalition was the passing of an immunity law modeled on the U.S. presidency to immunize the prime minister while he's in office. And this, he was doing this while he's under an investigation. And one of the reasons that he was unable to put together a government, not the principal reason, but one of the reasons, was anxiety about the immunity law. He then did less well in the second round of elections than he did in the first, and the immunity deal was kind of off the table in response. And so in that sense, Israeli democracy has performed, I think, quite admirably in its chaotic way. You know, a prime minister tried to pass a law to shield himself from criminal process, a popular prime minister, and the system stopped short of that and held off and allowed the indictment of that prime minister. And that's actually, just as a purely democratic accomplishment, that's pretty substantial.
All right, let's move on to object lessons. Ben, why don't you go first?
My object lesson is shit and an ass. And they both show up in the same conversation about which Gordon Sondland had with Mr. Holmes and the president, and Holmes testifies about it today. He is willing to say the president loves your ass. He is not willing to say he doesn't give a shit about Ukraine. And so my question, if I were a member of Congress and I had 5 minutes to talk to Mr. Holmes, I'd say to him, you know, political counselor Holmes, why are you comfortable saying ass in front of the Congress of the United States on national television, but you're too prudish to say the word shit? And I think this is really the takeaway that we should all be focused on.
I thought it was endearing.
Gotta have standards, man.
All right. Margaret, what's your object?
So I actually have 460 of them.
Are these pages?
No, they're actually pies.
Oh.
Yeah. And so my object lesson, you know, we're heading into the Thanksgiving season. So I just want to remind everyone, we all have much to give thanks for. I personally will be spending the weekend with 60 other volunteers baking 460 pies for families in need in the D.C. area. We are doing half pumpkin and half apple. I'm very excited. I spent a few weeks testing recipes, so they will be very delicious. So, yeah, that's my sort of message for going into the Thanksgiving week.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Susan, your object.
Well, to follow up on Margaret's more heartwarming object lesson, I have a less heartwarming object lesson. So my object lesson is a series of lawsuits. A more recent lawsuit by a NSC staffer, a former congressional staffer named Kash Patel, against the website Politico and a reporter, Natasha Bertrand, for reporting what appear to be true and accurate facts about Mr. Patel. Mr. Patel is using the same attorney as his former boss, Devin Nunes, who is also engaged in a series of lawsuits against both private individual citizens, Twitter, and also reporters and journalistic outlets that have reported, again, true but unfavorable information about him. I'm really surprised that the Nunes lawsuits have drawn a lot of attention because he's suing a fake cow on Twitter, and it's all really funny, and it sort of adds to how absurd and ridiculous Devin Nunes is. And it is absurd and ridiculous, but it's also really scary and really dangerous and really upsetting that we have not seen bipartisan condemnation, that we aren't even really seeing lawmakers, either Democrats or Republicans, being asked about this, about their colleagues and the former staff of their colleagues using lawsuits designed to chill free speech and public participation, an outright and direct attack on the First Amendment and free speech in the media. This is really, really corrosive stuff. It shouldn't be controversial. It should be easy for the GOP to condemn. And so I just offer these as a note of caution, that seeing this move from that it's alarming enough to see it from a member of Congress to now see it move to current staff of the White House. This is a really alarming development. People need to pay attention to it. People need to be asking how these individuals are in a position to bankroll these lawsuits, which can be quite expensive. So this really is just a warning that the people should be focused on this, and that it's not just a funny headline about Devin Nunes and fake cows on Twitter. It really is the ability to have a truly free, fair, and open media that can is allowed to rigorously report and not fear retaliation for doing so.
All right. Mine is on a little bit of a lighter note. Podcast fans know I like to recommend to them various films and TV shows I'm watching. So I'm watching The Mandalorian. Are you guys watching this?
No. I am not.
On Disney Plus. Do you know what this is?
I've seen tweets about it.
So The Mandalorian.
Is this the Baby Yoda one?
Chicken knows what it is. Yes.
Okay. I've seen pictures.
I love that that's what it's becoming known as. So you know Boba Fett, the character.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's kind of a Mandalorian. He's kind of not. Right? Back me up. He sort of is. He's sort of not. Anyway, the character who looks like Boba Fett. Well, now we're in a different part of the Star Wars universe where the Empire has fallen, and it's like the Wild West. So lots of themes about law and order, vigilante justice, bounty hunting. Our protagonist is a bounty hunter. Lots of themes that I think will resonate with people for the show. But to your point, Susan, it has featured this tiny little baby that looks like a Baby Yoda, or looks kind of like a Mogwai from the Gremlins films. And he's just so damn cute.
He is very cute.
He is adorable. And it spawned easily one of my favorite memes of recent memory, which somebody did playing on another meme, which is a picture of old Yoda from the original saying his famous line, "Do or do not, there is no try." And then a picture of Baby Yoda saying, "Okay, boomer." And then Yoda saying, "Listen here, you little shit." Look at this.
A meme of our time.
The internet just gives and gives.
And it's like Yoda's eyes are big and he's looking at it. Tell me that this was a gift. Even if it were not coming in the middle of a very trying and exhausting week, I would be down with this anytime. I'm here for Baby Yoda. I'm here for boomer memes. I'm here for The Mandalorian. You should be too. And I'm here for this podcast, which is sadly coming to an end.
And won't be here next week.
That's right. As a housekeeping note, you will not see us next week. I mean, we are playing with the emotions of our listeners. I apologize. We've gone from Wednesdays to Thursdays. We won't be here next week, but try and enjoy some time with your friends, with your family. Give thanks. Give thanks for this podcast, which is, of course, a production of Lawfare. And tell all your family and friends around the Thanksgiving dinner table that you can find our show page at lawfareblog.com. You can buy Rational Security Baby Yodas at Mandalorian Rational Security Store.tv. Don't sue us, Walt Disney. Would you rather be sued by Walt Disney Company or Devin Nunes? Take your pick. You can only choose one.
Walt Disney has better lawyers than Devin Nunes.
Yeah, I'd pick Nunes.
Careful, his lawyer might sue you now. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. Whenever you download the podcast, please remember to leave a rating and review. It helps us out. Our audio engineer this week is Jacob Schultz. The show is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell. Music this week by Gordon Sondland, who has recorded his own Mexican folk song. Have you heard about this? Yeah. It's called Les Gusta Tu Culo.
Oh.
What?
They love your ass.
Nice.
Nice.
I just wanted to work in some Spanish.
Very nice.
It's good.
You're pretty good at that.
I try. I don't know if Sophia Yan.
I love your ass.
Me gusta mi culo. Sure. Sophia Yan is not joining this band. She's not joining any bands. On behalf of my good friends Ben Wittes, Margaret Taylor, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. Hasta luego.